Good morning. My name is Matt Swartz, and I'm a partner in Pillsbury's Corporate, M&A, and Private Equity Group. The topic for today's discussion is Popular Delusion or the Best Bet? A discussion of current and anticipated developments in capital markets, investing, and the economy. Your microphones have been muted, but we encourage you to submit questions in writing. Please feel free to type your questions in the WebEx Q&A box, and we'll try to address as many of the questions as we can. And finally, we'll be sending you all a copy of the webinar recording after the presentation. We have with us on our panel this morning three very distinguished investors and asset managers. Our panelists combined manage investments valued at tens of billions of dollars on behalf of institutions and individuals, and each has been investing for more than 20 years. Let me introduce them. We have Pat Boyle, Senior Investment Strategist at Bessemer Trust, Vijay Chandar, Executive Director of Morgan Stanley Wealth Management Investment Resources, and Amy Raskin, Chief Investment Officer at Chevy Chase Trust and frequent guest on CNBC's Fast Money Halftime Report. Thanks to our event co-sponsors, Kips DeSanto Investment Banking and Cordia Partners. I would also like to thank Chris Pintaro of Bessemer Trust, Frank Vorndren of Morgan Stanley, and Stacy Murchison of Chevy Chase Trust. Let's first talk about government spending, deficits, and debt. Today's U.S. government debt is $28 trillion. Today's debt to GDP or gross domestic product ratio is 129%, the highest ever. After 9/11, that ratio was 50%. After the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan got underway seriously in 2004, it got to 60%. It started to really climb after the bank bailouts in 2009, but even then it was only 82%. It crossed 100% in 2013, and in 2019 it was 106%. President Biden signed President Biden signed a $1.9 trillion COVID-19 relief bill in March that brought federal spending to combat the pandemic over the last year to around $6 trillion. He also recently proposed an infrastructure and climate change plan that commits the government to $3 trillion in spending over the next 10 years. In inflation-adjusted dollars, the U.S. spent about $4.1 trillion waging World War II. It also spent more than $300 billion each on World War I and the Korean War, and $738 billion on the Vietnam War. The bill for the wars the U.S. has waged in Iraq, Afghanistan, and elsewhere since the terrorist attacks of 9/11 is $2.3 trillion and counting. All told, the U.S. has spent about $7.9 trillion on warfare since World War I. So COVID spending, somewhere around $6 trillion. All warfare spending since World War I, $7.9 trillion. From a Congressional Budget Office report that was delivered in March, the CBO projects that deficits and debt will trend upwards in the coming decades, with the debt-to-GDP ratio surpassing 200% by 2051 under current policy. Some of the possible consequences of persistent deficit spending include the crowding out of private investment, which can in turn shut down long-term growth, increasingly large portions of the federal budget being directed toward interest payments on debt, which can crowd out other policy priorities, and an unsustainable level of debt, which can lead to fiscal crisis. The CBO report then mentions low interest rates as a possible factor in managing the government's debt, and also the prospect of inflation and economic growth, each of which would help manage the debt load. One of the largest concerns about growing debt is the scenario in which, for any number of possible reasons, investors lose confidence in the U.S. government's ability to service its debt and therefore demand significantly higher interest rates to compensate for the risk. This type of scenario has led to fiscal crises in other countries. However, the U.S. is, in many ways, a different case because of the wide international use of the dollar. In times of crisis, like COVID-19, investors tend to flock to the dollar, which may allow the U.S. to borrow more easily and in larger amounts. The point at which the level of U.S. debt might become unsustainable is not clear. Given the current economic landscape, the country is not likely headed to crisis in the near term. However, depending on the speed and strength of the economic recovery and the way in which interest rates and inflation change, if at all, the size of the debt may become a more urgent concern in the future. Now, I'm about to ask our panelists a question, but some version of what I just said has been covered not only in other panels, but in lots of newspaper editorials and television interviews. But the rate of increase in the U.S. government's debt load and the speed of the increase in the ratio of debt to GDP is new. Both are growing so much faster than they were. So I'd like to begin by asking this. What are the near-term and long-term effects of this astonishing amount of spending and growth and incurrence of U.S. debts on economic performance and investments? And I'll start with Amy.
Wow, that was a mouthful, Matt. There's a lot there. The near-term implications of all this debt is stimulus. You're seeing that in the economic snapback and with the government giving money to people to help them through this crisis. The long-term implications are far less clear, but I will just make a couple of statements that are observations that temper some of the bearishness in the question. So debt to GDP is an interesting ratio, but from an economic perspective, what's a lot more important is the servicing cost of the debt. So with interest rates very low right now, that's not really a problem, and it's not projected to be a problem through most of this decade, actually. The CBOE, as you cited, does project it to, I think, go to between 13 and 14% of costs. So they do project it to be a problem, but they also are projecting a significant increase in interest rates, which is a very sort of subjective. It's not clear to me that that's going to happen. Especially, we've seen that with other countries with higher debt to GDP ratios, their interest rates have actually stayed very low. Japan being the case in point. So I think it's hard to predict dire long-term consequences at this point. I mean, the debt increase is largely driven, or it's largely driven by increased projections in medical costs that the government is projecting right now per person. And again, it's sort of unclear to me that that's really going to happen. And that's a policy choice that the government can choose to make or not make. It's not like we're on this kind of unsustainable trajectory that we can't get off if policy decisions are changed. So I, you know, in the list of things that I'm concerned about right now, this isn't, debt levels are not in the top three from a near term and actually even from a long term basis. I'll leave it at that. Let others.
Well, okay, so that begs the question, Amy, and I certainly want to hear Vijay's and Pat's thoughts, but should we leave the audience in suspense about what your top concerns are, or do you want to just give us a quick thought?
Yeah, we'll come back to that.
Amy's top three. Okay, I gotcha. All right, Vijay, government spending, debts, ratios, are you worried?
Sure. I mean, let me just add a couple of things, and I agree with a lot of what Amy just said. And first is, it's easy to get scared when we see a $25, $30 trillion debt figure. I think we always have to remember, any of us that look at our own personal balance sheets, you got to weigh assets against that debt too. And you think about the assets the United States has, I'd argue it's very well in excess of that $25 trillion. In fact, if you just look at household assets alone in the U.S., you're over $100 trillion today. So, from a balance sheet perspective, I don't think the debt's as scary, as some of the fearmongers out there would make it seem. But I think in the near term, what we have to weigh is first, we were embracing deficit spending before the pandemic, right? We had, blown out to a $1 trillion plus deficit Before things were really bad. And then last year that blows out to four, and who knows where that settles. And so if in the near term we've embraced deficit spending, to the tune of maybe, $2 trillion being this new normal, in the near term, it's going to be really good for growth, and I think we've learned that in the last year. It's head scratching how quickly this economic recovery has been post COVID. US GDP in the first quarter already set a new record. It's in large part because of all this stimulus that's been put out of Washington. So I think what we have to think about in the near term is, how long can that continue? And if it is sustainable for a couple of years, which we think it is, that's going to have some pretty bullish implications for fundamental growth. So in the near term, we do think it's a good thing, at least, for what it's going to mean for GDP. The risk I'll throw out, though, is if we think about funding those deficits and if we're going to issue $2 or $3 trillion of debt every year, we've been able to do that without a problem the last year because the Federal Reserve's been buying a ton of that debt. It's been almost matched up one for one what the Fed is buying versus what the Treasury is issuing, to finance deficit spending. Well, the conversation is going to start to shift here in the next 6 or 7 months, whereas the Fed thinks about pulling back, all these extraordinary measures. If they're buying less debt and we keep issuing it, supply demand would dictate bond prices go lower, interest rates go higher, and that could start to become a little bit of a problem. So I'll say, we don't think this is the big risk, similar to what Amy just said. I think in the near term, this deficit spending is very good for growth, but we do have to watch out for that interest rate mechanism, because if the Fed starts to step away a little bit, we keep issuing all this debt, rates could adjust higher, and that could put some pressure, as we think about what things look like a couple of years out.
Okay. I hear you. Now, Pat, I have a question for you that's concrete, but I also want to get your weigh-in on this fundamental point. Do you agree with the consensus, which seems to be this really isn't much to worry about?
Well, Matt, first, thanks for having me back. I very much appreciate being on here. I'm probably a little bit more worried. I think I agree with most things that have been said. I do think, though, the longer we ignore the debt and the deficit, or the longer we don't do something to correct it, the harder it's going to be. And I completely agree. It's very, very helpful in the short run when people are losing jobs and even the folks that have jobs aren't able to spend money because the economy is not open. You want your government stepping in and being the spender of last resort. So I think that makes perfect sense what they did. But I do think looking out and just looking at the difference between spending and tax revenues lately, it has ballooned even before the crisis. So if you go all the way back to the late 20s, we've averaged a deficit, meaning our spending has exceeded tax revenue by about 3% of GDP per year. In the last 10 years, that figure has been 5.4%. In the last year, it's 15%. Now, again, the spending in the last year, in our view, was completely necessary because of being in a pandemic and needing the government to help lead us out, and they did. But going forward, and Amy mentioned the big driver going forward is healthcare related spending. The longer we wait to rein that in and to better match our spending and our tax revenue, the harder it is to do. And I think politically, neither side has really campaigned on balancing the books, and both the left and the right have been big believers in spending. And hasn't they have not done a great job of matching tax revenue with spending. And so I think maybe I'm a little bit more worried than the other panelists in the long term. I don't think it's an issue that's going to implode the economy or the stock market tomorrow or in a year, but the longer we wait to fix it, the harder it becomes to fix.
Yeah, and I'll add, I don't mean to suggest that necessarily it's not within the ambit of the discussion to say which side is to blame. I'm just raising the question about the numbers.
Can I jump in for a second? Just one more point on this. Financial theory would tell you that if your interest rate is less than your growth rate, you should increase your debt. So there's also a big question here is what is the debt being used for? If the debt is being used for productivity improvements, And, you know, and you can make some arguments that infrastructure debt might be, you know, that might fall in that category. And again, I'm not trying to get political here, but that we should be increasing debt levels. So again, the interest rate is, as Vijay said, is really the critical factor here. You know, that's something to focus on. But with interest rates where they are now, you know, again, this it's not a problem.
Right. No, I hear you. And that was actually going to be my next question, which was to Pat, but I welcome others to answer as well. You know, it's the broad question is, we talk about, you know, government stimulus bringing growth. Is it the same kind of growth that we had without government stimulus? In other words, we've had growth before, like we had growth in the late 90s. We had growth preceding the last financial crisis. You know, economically, are those the same thing? And I guess a subset of that, which is maybe a different question, but along the same theme, you know, the government is continuing to give stimulus, direct stimulus payments to individuals, right? You know, couples earning up to 150,000, individuals earning up to 75,000. So maybe my two questions, and I'll start with Pat, but invite Amy and Vijay as well. You know, what's the impact of this direct payments to individuals, if it goes on past, you know, sort of the current helping of it, if you will, and what about stimulus led growth? I mean, in other words, how does that happen? Is that any different economically from growth that goes without government stimulus? So Pat, I'll invite you to answer first.
Yeah, Matt, I think it's I think it's not, you know, it's not typical to have this level of stimulus and have the direct payments to individuals the way we've had it. Obviously, we have a very complex transfer tax system, and there are some subsidies for folks. But the $5 or $6 trillion in spending that's financed completely by debt. That's temporary, and. And again, to my earlier point, I think it was necessary to help get us out of the crisis. And when individuals aren't spending and companies aren't really spending, when the economy is shut down, you need the government to step in and do that. But as the economy gets back to more normal, and I don't think it's going to get all the way to normal quickly, but it's going to get most of the way back, you will see that start to recede. And I think each new stimulus, or let me just say it this way, the things President Biden is talking about now, the infrastructure plan and some of the other things that he wants to do, those are likely to be financed with tax increases. So we're going to move from, you know, big stimulus that's not financed to some potential infrastructure and other stimulus that would be financed with tax increases. But I think it's you know, it's generally been helpful. The economy's bouncing back, the labor market's improving. You look at job growth for folks that have high school degrees or college degrees or advanced degrees, and most of the broad measures of job growth and the labor market look good and look like they're improving. And even the labor market is, which people thought might be very slow to heal, is moving in the right direction. So I view most of that big stimulus as temporary, and when it's all said and done, it gets back to all of the other regular drivers of the economy. And clearly, the government is one driver of the economy, but it'll be more of the slack will be taken up by consumers and businesses, which is what you would expect in non-pandemic times.
Okay. That's an interesting and fair perspective. Does anyone else have any thoughts on the kind of effect of the individual stimulus payments? I guess if we assume that this is the last round, that's one thing. But if they were to continue, what effect would that have on the economy, on capital markets, and so forth? I mean, it has the effect of changing people's incentives to seek work, right? I don't know. Again, I'm not turning this into a political debate. I'm just trying to make sure that we hit all angles on these issues. So What would the effect be economically of that? Go ahead, Amy.
So again, it depends on what the money is being used for. So far, the stimulus really has been used. Consumers have paid down debt with about a third of it. They've saved about a third of it, and they've spent about a third of it. So consumers have actually been pretty rational with what they've done with their money thus far. You've also seen record high new business formations after, you know, sort of two decades of business formation numbers falling. They're turning around and turning around fast, which, you know, could be very productivity enhancing in the future. So it depends. You know, so far we haven't seen them just be blown out and spent on, you know, consumer goods that, you know, won't offer a longer term return. Obviously, a lot of it has found its way into financial markets. You can make arguments whether that's good or bad, but I think there's no categorical answer because it depends on what the money is used for. I mean, if the money is used for childcare so a parent could go to work, you know, you would argue that that's stimulative for the economy and, you know, has a positive multiplier effect that we would like to see. If the money is used to buy sneakers, it's probably less so. It's hard to make a categorical answer. So far, it seems like it's been pretty stimulative.
Okay, so let me go to another topic, which I know is on a lot of people's minds, which is the proposed capital gains tax increase to 43.4%, which would be almost doubling where it is now. And I'm going to pick a couple of selected perspectives on this. One of them is the Wall Street Journal, which wrote an editorial about it entitled "The Dumbest Tax Increase." And I'll quote John F. Kennedy, who said, and I'm quoting, "The tax on capital gains directly affects investment decisions, the mobility and flow of risk capital from static to more dynamic situations, the ease or difficulty experienced by new ventures in obtaining capital, and thereby the strength and potential for growth of the economy." The Congressional Budget Office, it was reported, has itself reported that the revenue maximizing rate for capital gains for the government is 28%, and that above that rate, people stop completing transactions that create taxable income, so the government's revenue declines when capital gains taxes exceed 28%. So I guess I'll start with Vijay and say, dumbest tax increase. Your reaction, and what do you think it'll be? What would the effects of it be on capital markets and investing?
Sure. Look, you know, I don't have a strong view about, you know, what's good policy and what's bad policy here. And, you know, look, I think the administration's been pretty upfront on this, that it's not even necessarily a policy that's driven by, you know, an economic view. It's driven more in, I think, their view about trying to make the tax code more equitable. So is it populist in that sense? You know, sure. But as we think about what it means from a market perspective, you know, the presence of the tax debate might be as good a catalyst as any, you know, against this, you know, kind of backdrop of you have a market that's kind of extended to begin with to inject some volatility. But are tax rates actually going up, and are they going to go up to the level that's, you know, been proposed a couple of weeks ago? It's going to be really difficult, I think, for Washington to get this across the goal line, because you have a very tenuous majority on the Democratic side. You're going to have all 50 senators, and you're going to have the majority of Democratic Congress votes get behind this as well in the House. And it's not going to be that easy. You know, you've already heard enough rumblings, you know, talking about individual senators or individual, you know, representatives, where, you know, raising taxes, you know, going into the midterm elections next year might not be a winning strategy. And so, you know, we do think there's likely changes to the tax code made next year. There's the possibility for that might be enough to, you know, drive some selling. But as it stands today, to be honest, we think it's a much bigger risk on the corporate side that rates go up, where it seems like you have general agreement, as opposed to individual side or capital gains, where, you know, as we really start negotiating this thing within the Democratic Party, unclear where that final plan would result. But look, in any case, I'll say we've done some data on this, and every situation's different. But if you look historically at when capital gains rates increased, it was not devastating to the market. It was not devastating to the economy. And, you know, we think we have enough robust growth here that, you know, an increase, you know, to
Vijay?
Hey, Matt, it's Pat. I think maybe I'll just paraphrase what I'm guessing Vijay might have concluded with, which is the economy is strong enough that even if capital gains rates go up, the economy and the stock market should be able to survive.
Well, and I hope Vijay, just in case you can hear us, we couldn't hear you there for a bit, but I guess I'll ask, and let me ask Amy. You know, I mean, it's one thing to go up, right? I mean, and we've all experienced that in our careers. It's another thing to make the capital gains rate basically at par with ordinary income rates, which makes investors indifferent as to how they earn their return, right? So going back to John F. Kennedy's quotes, I mean, I think I do a lot of private company mergers and acquisitions, and I feel like a business owner would say, gosh, you know, if I'm going to be taxed for the sale of my business at the same rate I'm taxed at basically continuing to get paid out of my business, either as a salary bonus or distribution dividend, why would I sell it? Because then you know, there isn't any place good to reinvest the money right now, at least not with a secure, not a secure one's rates are so low. So from my ground level perspective, it sure seems like the proposed rate, and I certainly heard BJ's thought that that won't be what shakes out of Congress, but the proposed rate, it seems to me it, there would be a common sense view that it would. I certainly think business owners contemplating selling would their behavior would be impacted if there was no difference in the rates as to how they got their income. What do you think, Amy?
If there was a change in the capital gains rate now, I would certainly expect people to try to sell in advance of that, where, you know, the economy is very hot right now, and the markets are hot, you know. So given where we are, I would certainly expect people to get out, try to get out before that. That's sort of what I would think the biggest sort of near-term impact would be. There's very, I think, as Vijay was saying, there's very little correlation between economic growth and the capital gains tax. If you know, there are not that many data points, but if you go back in time and look at growth when the capital gains tax was high and the capital gains tax was low, there's no correlation there that you can really draw any significant conclusion. But you know, the change in the short term, I think it would be silly not to expect it to it impact markets if it were to happen.
Just to make sure I understood what you said, then you said you think basically it would impact the markets if it
I
happened.
think
Do
it
I
would.
understand?
I think it would from a short-term perspective. Just given where we are, I think it would. It would cause people to try to sell in advance. I mean, there are a lot of other, you know, ironically, you know, if they don't change the estate tax and the death tax, and they don't change the step up, maybe people would not sell because they would hope that they would get a step up at death or something. You know, like, so the capital gains tax change is one part of a broader potential changes to the tax mosaic. So I think you have to look at it holistically. But if it was just the capital gains tax, I wouldn't be surprised if we got some selling, especially in the widely held stocks that had very high gains. Or, you know, again, if somebody who's thinking about selling their business now or next year might say, you know, the 15% change in tax would cause me to sell it earlier rather than hold on. So
Right. Well,
I
and I
think it would
guess,
impact behavior. Yeah.
And I guess let's, I mean, assume, realize I totally accept what BJ was saying about the prospect of changes as it goes through Congress, but just for the sake of analysis and discussion, assume that something like what the president described does get passed and that there is selling this year to avoid the what we assume would be an impact next year rather than this year. Looking past this year, wouldn't you think that, gosh, if I'm an investor, wouldn't I start favoring things that distribute cash now over things that, you know, are going to provide capital appreciation? Because, you know, I get money today that's taxed the same way as a sort of a riskier long-term growth plan, right? I mean, wouldn't you think that you would start to think strategically a little bit differently if there's no difference in how those two kinds of returns are taxed?
Matt, I don't know who you're throwing that one out to, but
Anyone,
yeah,
jump
okay,
off.
I'll take it. I think it would cause people to think differently than they do now, and I think that's a good point. I think it's extraordinarily unlikely we will have a 40% long-term capital gains rate. And I say that listening to some of the Democratic senators talking about not supporting it. And remember, we all know the political situation. To pass it in the Senate, they would need all 50 Democrats. And as far as I can tell, two or three or four of them are not in favor of it. So I don't want to say dead on arrival. And with politics, you never know. But I think when the dust settles, capital gains rates will be higher than they are today. But, you know, maybe they'll end at 25 or 28%, and they will still be lower than the ordinary income rate. I think, two other points just to give some perspective. Remember, President Biden has said that the capital gains rate, he would like to see that double for people who have income above $1 million. So that doesn't affect, right. It certainly affects a lot of the clients that the panelists work with, but that doesn't have a huge impact on the typical American, at least a big direct impact. And then the other markets reason, I think just some evidence in support of what the two panelists have said, one of the reasons that the market isn't all that sensitive to capital gain changes in the long run is there's an awful lot of money in the market that's non-taxable, pension assets, IRA assets, foundation assets, which they have a very, very small tax, but you're kind of indifferent. If in my IRA capital gains rates go up, do I care? No, not really. And so I completely agree. Taxes are certainly one thing. They could disrupt the market a little bit in the short run, but in the long run, they're one of many things that influence the economy and the markets. And even if we did have higher tax rates, I think the economy and the markets can survive that.
Okay. All right. Sounds good. Vijay, do we have you back?
I think so. Can you hear me?
We can. Yes. So I want to now, we've been talking about the markets. I'm still waiting to hear Amy's top three concerns, so we have to leave time for that. But let's talk about the market. The last time we met, the last time we had a panel discussion on these topics was in the third week of September. And it's interesting. I went back and compared the closing prices for the S&P 500 and NASDAQ and the Dow the day before that panel to the day to yesterday. And they've all gone up kind of right around 28% since September. I mean, massively up. In fact, the Dow had a record closing yesterday, right? So my fundamental question is, how long can this possibly go on? And this is part of my part of the reason for the name of the panel, as advertised, is a popular delusion. And this year, the Dow has had 17 record high closings, and we're not through the second quarter yet. The S&P has had 19 record high closings. There's this whole phenomenon called SPACs, special purpose acquisition companies, which is a little wonky in its this sort of details, but these blank check vehicles, which raise capital to go out and find a company to buy, have raised almost $90 billion in 2021 already, exceeding the entire year of 2020, when only $83.4 billion was raised. So there's something in the mid $171 or more billion dollars in SPAC money is out there looking for companies to buy. And there's more than 400 SPACs looking for deals right now. So the overall question, when I ask the question, is this a popular delusion, is really, are we in an asset bubble? Are we kind of whistling our way along the edge of the cliff? And you hear about home prices, and the only thing that really, for the time being, seems to be low is interest rates, and that's another topic. So, Pat, are we in a bubble? Should we start packing a parachute so that we land softly? What's going on?
Yeah, I think there are areas of the market that feel a bit frothy, but I also think there are some pretty significant tailwinds that the economy and the financial markets have. So we talked about fiscal spending that we all seem to agree in the short run is helpful for consumers and the economy. We've talked a little bit about monetary policy. The Fed has said over and over they want to keep rates low. They're more worried about taking the accelerator off the gas too early. And so because of that, they're going to keep rates low for a while. And then we've had a lot of success since this panel last convened. You know, one of the big things that's different is a significant improvement in the COVID situation, particularly in the US, but globally as well. And remember, it wasn't until November 7th or 8th, I think, when Pfizer or the one of the vaccine makers announced their trial results that were 94, 95% effective. And so I think that's a, you know, those three things have conspired together to really lift the markets higher. Is it sustainable over the long run? No. I mean, markets don't go up at 25 or 28% in a short period of time. You know, you look back the last 100 years, stocks on average have done about 10% a year. So you could even make the argument that because valuations are a little bit stretched, that you might lower your long-term estimate for the capital markets over the next 5 or 10 years to say 7 or 8%. So what we've the joy that we've experienced in stocks the last couple of years and the last several months definitely unsustainable. And I think, you know, having those longer term numbers ingrained in people's mind is much more realistic. All that said, we do feel like there's a pretty good economic tailwind now for those reasons that I laid out. And so it could the markets could go higher in the short run. I would also say, and I know this kind of sounds boring given the topic of the panelists, but or the topic of the panel, it's really hard to time the equity market. I don't know anyone that's done it consistently and is still in business over a long period of time. And so we're in most times we think clients should come up with a long-term asset allocation and some mix of stocks and bonds that can get them through the ups and the downs. And we wouldn't be all that different from a client's long-term asset allocation today.
That's interesting. So, Amy, when we were putting together the title of this panel, and we had a subsequent discussion, you were saying, you know, maybe if I can paraphrase, you know, maybe the market is overheated, but maybe it still has room to go. What is your thought about the asset potential that we're in an asset bubble? And one of the things I think implicit in what Pat was saying about, you know, growth rates as they've been versus how they normally are and we might expect them to be, you know, is it reasonable to say that the version of the correction in the market that you might see is just slower growth, not necessarily, you know, some kind of market, you know, correction that's significantly downward? I mean, where are you on these things?
Yeah, I think it's hard. It's going to be hard to get a huge, a huge downturn in the market right now. There's just too much money out there. There's too much money trying to find investments. We've had more money flow into the equity market year to date in 2021 than every other full year except for 2017. And we're certainly on our way, if we continue at this trajectory, to outpace 2017. So there's just a lot of money out there chasing returns. And the equity market is expensive, but if you look at it relative to the fixed income market or even the housing market, or, you know, some of markets that I would consider even crazier, like Bitcoin or NFTs, you know, or art, you know, all of every asset market right now looks very expensive. And yet there are, you know, trillions of dollars that need to be invested. And so, you know, any valuation metric, again, looks high, but people need to put money to work. And I think that's the prevailing force in the markets right now.
So it's kind of like, sorry, Amy, go ahead.
No, that's it. Yeah, I mean, go ahead.
So if I can summarize, yeah, everything is pricey, but what are you going to do? We got to put money somewhere. Is that a fair way
that's
to say
basically,
it?
Basically, I mean, I think that's what's driving the markets right now. So anytime you sort of see a sector pull back, your money comes in. Anytime you sort of get a little bit of a correction, you see money come in. I think there are a lot of people waiting on the sidelines. To put money to work, and so I wouldn't be surprised if we get a 5 or 10% pullback. Sure, we could easily get that, but to see something much larger before the Fed acts, I think is probably not going to happen. Once the Fed starts tapering, or once the Fed basically says interest rates are going up, all bets are off, this market's coming down. But right now, with the economic growth being so robust and Powell firmly saying I'm on the sidelines, this party can continue.
Okay, Vijay, you vehemently disagree here. You think we're on the edge of a cliff, or you think there's still 50% growth to be had?
I mean, look, I'd say I don't think those are the only two outcomes. And, our feeling here at Morgan Stanley is that, the market's acting maybe a little bit more extreme than normal, but largely it's doing what it's supposed to do as you come out of recession and have the first year off of a big bear market low, which is, people got too negative last year, and then the data started improving late last year. We've got a ton of fiscal policy, a ton of monetary policy, and we've had a great rally. And now, call it 13 months removed from the lows, it should get a little bit harder. So look, valuations are high. The S&P is trading 22.5 times forward earnings. Those forward earnings are already embedding a pretty healthy growth number. So, we think the market's probably fully valued for a bull case scenario. I'm not going to tell you the market's cheap. We do think that the higher likelihood move here in the next few months is probably a 5 to 10% correction. But what we really need to pay attention to of what kind of drives that churn is, I think if we look at what's driven the market the last 12 months, first it was one-way fiscal policy, right? Washington continued to surprise us to the upside by doing more and more. Well, what are we going to be talking about in the next 6 or 7 months? It's probably not as bullish, right? We're talking about taxes. So that becomes a headwind. I think the second big one is the Fed. The Fed could do no wrong for the last 13, 14 months. Well, as we get better economic data, we're inching towards a taper. And when that happens, I think you're going to see the market adjust, as Amy just mentioned it. And we might already be seeing it, right? The tip of the spear of speculation in the equity market, you touched on SPACs. There's been a ton of weakness in SPACs the last few months. If we look at the high valued growth companies, right, all of last year's darlings, the profitless technology stocks, they've corrected 20, 30, in some cases, 50%. So I think the market's getting ready for that. And then just the third thing I'd throw out that we need to watch out for is, as good as the data is today, this is probably as good as it gets on a rate of change basis, meaning as we go into the rest of the year, we're likely to see a deceleration in growth. And so when you no longer have, massive earnings beats, GDP surprising to the upside, continued upwards revisions, as that gets baked in and starts to roll over, it makes sense that the market comes under a little bit of pressure. So our view is not that we're in a bubble. Looking out 2 or 3 years, we actually think you can justify higher equity prices. There's a lot to like. But in the near term, valuations are priced for perfection. And if any one of those three things starts to tilt the other way, we think it drives a correction. And that's usually what happens, call it year one to year two of a new bull market.
Okay, well, let me ask the panel then. I mean, are there equity investing themes that make sense now? And of course, I wouldn't ask any of you to name any companies, but sectors that you think are out of favor and are not currently benefiting from the market's updraft, but which will see, in your belief, kind of meaningful growth or recognition of their value over the medium term. Any sectors come to mind that you guys are interested in?
Sure. I'll start, and maybe I'll throw three out there. But, within the U.S., we still our view that interest rates probably go a little bit higher, the economy is going to be pretty good. If valuations are concerned, the financial sector is trading at less than 14 times earnings today. And so we think, the financial sector continues to look good through the rest of the year into next year. Healthcare is another one. Believe it or not, healthcare has been one of the worst performing sectors through the pandemic. I would not have guessed that 13 months ago. As a result, relative valuations are attractive. And then the final thing I just say is look outside the U.S. We've had a significant amount of weakness, looking outside of the United States. And we think that there's, decent opportunities in Europe, in Asia, and emerging markets, especially if you're long-term focused.
Okay. Pat, Amy, sectors of interest, healthcare, financials, OUS.
Maybe I'll just mention one. We're still pretty optimistic on technology, and certainly there are some very speculative tech companies that aren't making any money. There are some other big tech companies that are generating a ton of free cash flow. yes, they're more expensive than historically they've been, but we still like their secular growth stories over the next 3 years or 5 years. So we still have an overweight in technology.
Amy, you always have some interesting investment ideas and
Sure.
themes. Tell me what's on your mind.
We agree with Vijay, sort of ex-US, there are more opportunities than in the US, just given the valuation discrepancies and likely growth rate acceleration outside the US. Expectations are not quite not quite as frothy, and Europe looks like they're just 6 weeks behind us in terms of their vaccination rollout and growth. So we like a lot. So we're definitely looking more overseas and have been. We still like the energy sector. We went overweight energy, I think, sort of towards our last call. We took money out of tech. We're not as bullish on tech. We think that's been overdone for the most part. There are companies certainly within technology that we like, but as a sector, we moved underweight a while back, but we think energy still has a lot of room to run if economic growth is nearly as strong as it's supposed to be projected. Just the underinvestment into the energy complex has been huge. We like certain areas of healthcare, not big pharma per se. We think they're going to be disrupted. We're very focused on a lot of innovation and productivity improvements in healthcare that we think at some point will help that budget deficit that we were talking about, and probably sooner
Wow.
rather than later. Yeah.
That sounds good. That sounds really interesting. You guys helped cure my bearish concerns here. I appreciate it. It's interesting. So, inflation and interest rates comes up, and none other than Warren Buffett said, I think it was this week, it may have been last week, and I'm quoting, "We are seeing substantial inflation," he said at the Berkshire Hathaway shareholder meeting. "We are raising prices. We are seeing rising prices, and people are rising prices to us, and it's being accepted." Now, Treasury Secretary Yellen said that the Fed should raise rates to cool economic growth, or at least suggested that, and then seemed to walk it back. Now, the Wall Street Journal has a column called Streetwise, and that I believe it was the day before yesterday, the headline was, "Everything Screams Inflation." And the subheading was, "Investors are woefully unprepared for what may be a once-in-a-generation shift in the market." Now, I have a feeling you guys are going to moderate this, but I'll go on and give the substantiation that article offered. It said, central banks are less concerned about inflation and so less likely to step in and try to control it. Government spending is more than ever. The guardrails are off. Globalization is out. Free trade created competition that held prices down. The world is moving to a more protectionist kind of footing, even with the change in US administrations. Demographics, the US population growth in the last decade is the slowest since the 1930s. So with fewer workers, there's less competition and higher wages. And it mentioned in the United States, labor union influence is growing, which pushes up wages. So what about inflation? I mean, I suppose you could say we already have it, it's just low. You could say we have it and it's high, it's going to be here. But the question is, when does it come and how big is it? And I don't have anyone for this question, so I'll go with Ivan asked Amy first
I'll
in a few
jump in.
questions.
Yeah,
Go ahead.
because this is one of my biggest concerns. We haven't had inflation in most investors' lifetime at this point. I mean, the last sort of big inflation period was the 1970s. So, it's a big question, and it's super important for the markets. If inflation goes up, that's what's going to get the Fed active at some point. That's what's going to get interest rates higher. That's what's going to put the multiple pressure on the market. So this is the most important question of the day. If we're ever going to get inflation, this is the time that we're going to get inflation. As you list a lot of impetus for inflation, the fiscal stimulus, you know, just the lack of investment in a lot of commodity complexes over the last decade. You know, even the green and moving to more sustainable green energy is inflationary. You could add the end of Moore's law. You know, we're not seeing the deflation that we used to see in technology. If globalization reverses, that's very inflationary. Demographic trends, everything is conspiring right now. Plus, you have consumers with a ton of pent up savings and a ton of pent up demand all hitting the market at one time. So the Fed has said, we're going to get inflation. We have inflation. The Fed has said that they think it's transitory. They're not going to move until they're sure it's not transitory. So sort of by definition, they're saying that they're going to be late. And we know inflation itself is a lagging indicator. So, you know, here's the question. And Powell seems to think that he can do it. He said, if inflation runs hot for longer, we have the tools to rein it in. Now, that's true. They do have the tools to rein it in. But do they have the tools to rein it in without causing a recession and or a huge market correction? And we just don't know, because we've never been in this situation before. You know, the Fed has always been sort of anticipatory about inflation, and now they're saying they're not going to be. So it's a huge regime change. It's probably the most important question for the market. It's, you know, Larry Summers has come out and said, you know, he thinks there's a 1/3 chance that inflation spirals out of control. I think we sort of agree with those odds. You know, there certainly is, you know, after three decades, there's a lot of deflationary factors that are still in place. But again, you just have this perfect storm of events that are conspiring to potentially lead to inflation. And it's something that, as a money manager, you have to take very seriously.
Gosh, I have so many follow-up questions, but let me let the other panelists weigh in. Vijay?
Sure. I mean, I think I agree with everything Amy just said, so you know, I won't belabor those points.
Okay.
The only thing I would just add would be, you know, we're coming out of a cycle where inflation in the U.S., let's say, averaged about 1.7. You know, our feeling is, for many of the reasons Amy just said, even outside of the pandemic, that inflation in the cycle ahead is likely to be slightly higher. But, you know, we think slightly higher means something in the low twos, which may not sound like a lot, but that's a very different investment backdrop, you know, call it slightly inflationary as opposed to disinflationary. And that would lead to pretty significant changes, you know, in how you want to manage money. But I agree with everything Amy just said.
Pat, are you going to be the dissenter, or are you in line here?
Yeah, why don't I dissent just for the fun of dissenting? No, I agree with most of what everyone has said. I think I'm not quite as concerned about inflation over the long run. I mean, I think it's already here. I was chatting with a client last week who has a business and has seen his steel prices double. He's also buying a house. He's seen his lumber prices double. And, you know, it's hard to kind of square the real world there. And then you look at CPI or PPI or CPE that the Fed looks at, or PCE, I mean, and you see numbers of like 2 or 3%. So the real world already feels like there's inflation. I think the key question is it just something that we're going to feel for 6 months, 9 months, a year? Or are we likely in this significantly higher inflationary regime for a while? And I think we would probably bet on the former, not the latter. And so it does seem like there's this perfect storm right now. Because of that, prices for a lot of things are already up. Inflation expectations have gone up, whether you look at the markets or you look at surveys. So inflation already has gone up, but I think we think that the odds of a huge inflationary boom over multi-year period are still not zero, but still fairly low. And in our view, the Fed still has credibility. And if investors lose credibility in the Fed, you know, inflation in some ways can be a bit of a self-fulfilling prophecy. So what you think is going to happen to inflation, is factored into that inflation equation. And so as long as the Fed stays credible and they fight it when they need to fight it, I think it's unlikely to get out of control. But you know, who knows? It's based on the future, so we're all just making our best guess.
So okay. So if Larry Summers, you know, who is credible, says there's a chance that inflation gets out of control, I wonder what he means by out of control. That's a scary concept, right? But so Amy, I'll ask you to.
Yeah, I think what he means is that the inflation gets high and the Fed can't put it back without taking fairly draconian measures. If the Fed has to raise interest rates, short-term rates to 4% to get inflation under control, the economy is going into a recession. That's the thought. Typically, again, for all of our history, the Fed has tried to be in front of inflation because its effects are so damaging to the economy, and to try to not let it get out of control. So this is a huge change. I mean, it's as important as the Volcker change, when he basically said, we're going to do everything we can to stop inflation. The Fed didn't have credibility up till then, and then Volcker changed it and the Fed had credibility. Powell's basically saying, we're going to do everything we can to get inflation. And given debt levels, you do want some inflation. The question is, can he keep it in this Goldilocks regime where it's not too hot, not too cold? And we've never tried this before. So it's a very important experiment.
Well, so, and I'll ask each of you, or perhaps whoever wants to answer first, let's assume that inflation is coming, though that isn't, certain. I mean, it's a big concern. It made Amy's top three. What is the strategy that you advise clients on in an inflationary environment? I mean, people love to talk about gold, but gold isn't really, as a non-expert in these matters, it doesn't seem like gold is a reliable hedge except against Armageddon, maybe, and not even that. So what do you advise people?
Yeah, Matt, maybe I'll jump in on that first. So I think the first thing you need to think about is, what's my view on inflation and what's already priced into the market? And if after thinking through that, you say, okay, I think inflation is going to be a lot higher than what the market's already priced in, if you come to that conclusion, then I think you look in the fixed income market, you would probably want to shorten your maturities. You might also consider TIPS, Treasury Inflation Protected Securities. You might, as you said, Matt, consider some commodities. I completely agree with you that gold is a bit inconsistent of a hedge, and so rather than making a big bet on gold or any one thing, maybe you try and buy a broad basket of commodities or commodities index. You're in the equity market, you probably lean more towards commodity producers, and then outside of equities, real estate historically has been a pretty decent inflation hedge. I do think there's one thing that's misunderstood in the financial markets by a lot of people. If all of a sudden we have a big surge in inflation in the short run, everyone knows that's bad for bonds. That's bad for stocks too. And the reason it gets confused is over the long run, over 20 or 30 years, stocks are a great inflation hedge. But that's very different from saying stocks do well when inflation rears its head, which they don't. In the short run, they don't do well. So if you really had a crystal ball, which no one does, but if you did, and it told you inflation was going to go up a lot, shorten your duration, reduce exposure to equities, tilt your equities towards commodity related equities, have a little bit of commodity basket exposure, and maybe a little real estate.
BJ, Amy, anything to add to that recommendation?
We do own gold now. We think it's worth the hedge. And I do think if we get into an inflationary environment, gold is going to dramatically outperform other assets. I mentioned our energy exposure. You will have commodities do better, and you will have fixed income do terribly poorly. And equities, won't work well, but they'll be better than most. Better than most other assets. So that's what you're seeing now with equity inflows at the levels that they are. And again, at record levels year to date. And I think part of that is being driven by inflation. But again, since the Fed has basically said, we expect inflation in the short term, and again, you know, the year over year comparison numbers are going to be, you know, just they're kind of irrelevant at this point, given what we're comping against. I think this is going to take a while to really to get a consensus about, or to get sort of really an understanding whether inflation is here durably. Yeah, currently here.
Okay. And Vijay, anything to add to the recommendation if we have inflation?
No, I agree with them. I would just summarize it by saying, you know, if you're moving into an inflationary regime, real assets, you know, should do better than financial assets. And you know, I think Pat listed a lot of them. The only thing I would say is, I think Pat touched on this, but, you know, traditionally you might think buy tips if you're worried about inflation, but the market's pricing in a lot. You know, the tips market today is pricing in a 10-year inflation break even of almost 2.5%. And so expectations there, I think, are just too high. So counterintuitively, even if you're worried about inflation, I'm not sure I'd be buying tips here. I think there's better places to be in that real asset universe.
Yeah, I agree with Vijay on that. I should have added that.
So I guess it's interesting. One of the things that everyone had mentioned was financials as sectors of the economy. In an inflationary environment, I guess if we assume interest rates rise, the financial sector should benefit, right? I mean, on the other hand, I suppose no economically damaging phenomenon is good for financial stocks. But if we get inflation, would you say you're more or less bullish on the financial sector?
We're not bullish on financials right now. I mean, we closed some of our underweight. We've been underweight for 7 years since I've joined Chevy Chase Trust, and it's been the right call and one of our better calls. But, you know, and we sort of closed the underweight thinking that we were going to get an increase in interest rates, and that happened. There's still too much capacity in the financial services industry. There's virtually no loan growth right now. There's no demand for loan growth because there's just too much cash out there. And so I think, you know, I think financials has, and then you could just sort of bring in this whole like fintech world and potential competition even increasing from here. So I, you know, again, if financials is not, especially in the US, is not a place that we're looking to go overweight regardless of inflation.
So let me ask, you know, I'm very eager to hear Amy's other two critical issues, you know, the things you worry the most about. One was inflation. What are the other two?
So, you know, what I'm also worried about is that expectations are really high. You know, if you look at just market, you know, just what people are expecting at this point, and I think DJ touched on this, I agree, you know, stocks with amazing earnings and great numbers are going down, you know, and again, there's just a lot of very high expectations built into the markets at this point. There's a lot of margin debt, record levels of margin debt. Again, people are going out on the risk spectrum to get to chase returns because the return environment is really tough. So, you know, so things better be awesome because the market's expecting it at this point. You know, we're focused on this semi shortage, you know, that has the really the ability to derail the economy and just in supply chain shortages in general, that, you know, again, expectations are high. And then you really do have to worry about, you know, geopolitical events like what's going on in Taiwan is scary. There's just a lot of, it just feels like there are a lot of tensions that are not being, you know, properly discounted at this point. You know, what's going on in India? There's just, you know, right now, I do think, and I think maybe BJ said this, the market is priced for perfection. And yes, we have a lot of stimulus in the pipeline and economic growth is stronger than it's been for 40 years. And there's a lot of good things that could potentially happen, but I don't think people are, you know, inflation's my number one concern, which inflation ties to interest rates and multiples, but expectations are high and, you know, nobody can plan for a black swan event, but we know they happen every few years. So we just had one, and you know, at some point we could potentially have another one.
So the other two questions I want to ask, because we're starting to get low on time. What it's funny, I want to ask about Japan, because you talked about OUS investing, and Japan is perhaps the only other industrialized country with, well, let's say industrialized, the only other major economic power with debt to GDP ratio, however, you know, marginal a measure of actual, you know, financial soundness that is, as the U.S. And part of it is because they've spent so much money in stimulus trying to breathe life into their economy. They're still have terribly low growth. With the limited time we have, I don't want to focus on Japan. I will ask you, though, what's the chance, through all the things we're talking about, that the U.S. dollar loses its status as the world's reserve currency? And would that change things radically for U.S. investors and for our economy? Pat, what do you think?
I think it's unlikely in the short run, or even maybe in the intermediate term, because if the U.S. loses its status as the world's reserve currency, then the next question is, well, what is the world's reserve currency? Is it the Chinese currency? Is it the euro? Is it Bitcoin? That's a joke. But you never know. And not to, you know, poke fun at Bitcoin, I mean, you really don't know. But I don't think any of those or any other currencies are really competitors for the dollar in the next 3 years, 5 years, 10 years. But over the long run, you never know. And certainly, you know, if you just look at China, their economy has grown enormously. They're not only a potential economic competitor, they're, you know, we worry about them a little bit as far as what they're doing in Taiwan. And as their economy continues to grow and develop, I think they would love to see their currency on par with the dollar. And for a lot of reasons, I don't think it's going to happen soon. But the second part of your question, you know, if and when that did happen, would it be a game changer? Absolutely. Because up until, you know, for as long as I can remember, we are the world's reserve currency. And in a time of crisis, even if we, the United States, causes the crisis, what do investors tend to run to? U.S. Treasuries and the U.S. dollar. And if that's not the case, I think you got to price assets differently. And yeah, so I think you would fundamentally have to rethink things. Fortunately, I don't think we're going to be in a position to having to do that anytime soon. But over the super long run, there are plenty of alternatives, whether it's digital currencies or other economic competitors that would certainly love to take our place.
So Amy, I mean, I'd like your answer fundamentally to the question, but one of the questions I've always had about investing in China, and maybe even more about their currency, is they're so subject to, frankly, you know, government control and manipulation. I mean, all countries to a certain extent probably engage in some manipulation of their currency. But what is your answer to the question about the chances that the U.S. will no longer be the world's reserve currency? And could you address China specifically? Because I just feel like
that's
even more remote.
I'm going to quote Larry Summers again, and I hope I get this right. He said, Europe is a museum, Japan is a nursing home, China is a jail, and Bitcoin is an experiment. So basically, the U.S. dollar wins out of default. I'm not super worried about China's economy taking off and being more competitive than the U.S. economy. They took an exactly opposite approach to COVID in almost every way, certainly fiscally, than we did. And in many cases, if you're a debt hawk, you would argue that they're being more responsible than we are at this point. But they have a lot of issues before. I mean, demographics being sort of the number one focus right now. You know, I do think we need to deal with China as as not just the U.S. alone, I do think that will happen. So I'm not overly concerned about the yuan becoming a reserve currency. Although the government is, you know, the Chinese government is very smart in how they're approaching trying to get the yuan as a currency. And they're, you know, the analogy has been made that they're sort of taking the Apple approach. Like Apple didn't go after Microsoft's enterprise business. They started a consumer business and then sort of tried to get in that way. So, you know, the way that China's going about trying to get the yuan more accepted, they're not directly going after the dollar's status. They are creating digital currency. They're doing some other things. No one can say what happens in the long term, but near term, it's not in my top three.
Vijay, your top, I mean, is that in your top three?
In the near term, no, but I don't spend any time worrying about the dollar losing its reserve currency status, you know, but it's not to say the dollar can't weaken a little bit. It's not to say that, you know, China can't take a bigger role in financial markets, because we do think all these things happen. But, you know, I'd echo what the other speakers have said, which is just, you know, the dollar's place as a trade currency, as a reserve currency, you know, I don't think that's going away. But, you know, I would watch China in the next decade. You know, China's doing a lot of interesting things to try to attract, you know, foreign capital flows, you know, to make the yuan a trade currency. And so I think that will grow, but none of this is going to happen overnight. And I don't think the rise of China is necessarily, you know, a competitive threat to the dollar in the next 10 or 20 years. And I'd also just expand on what Amy said, is as much as the next 10 years, you know, China's going to have a lot potentially going right, you know, demographics are going to be a huge issue for China with aging population. And looking beyond that, you know, I don't think China's competitive position is as strong as a lot of people might believe, you know, just looking at the growth trajectory in the last couple of decades.
Okay, so listen, we have 3 minutes, three panelists, one question. And I asked you this last time we met. You guys were, as always, insightful and spot on. So I'm going to ask you, Amy, first, let's assume we wait a year this time to reconvene the panel. What are the topics going to be? I mean, you know, what are we going to be worrying about most in a year? Will we say, gosh, the market only went up 4%? Or will we say it dropped 12%? Well, we say inflation is going crazy, you know? I mean, what do you predict for a year from now, very briefly, Amy?
I do think, a year from now, we're going to be worrying about compares to pent-up demand after COVID. And you're probably going to have earnings being weaker and growth being slower. That's my best guess. Whether we're worried about inflation is going to be, if we're worried about inflation, then we're going to be focused on Fed tightening and fiscal stimulus withdrawal. Although, you know, if we get there again, then you know, the we're spending a lot of time thinking about what's the second derivative of that. You know, so we don't think that the market can really handle a lot of, you know, even a little bit of Fed tightening at this point. So, I think what we'll be worrying about is comparative growth rates, supply chains, inflation, and what the Fed's going to do, which is kind of what we're worried about now.
B before C, so Pat Boyle before Vijay Shandar. What do you think, Pat?
Yeah, I think I hope it's not COVID. I hope there's not a new strain that surprises us and fools the scientists. So hopefully it's not that. I think it's going to be all about the Fed. You know, what's the Fed doing? Have they hiked yet? If they haven't hiked yet, are they tapering? How much are they tapering? And when are they going to hike? So I would say it's going to be all about the Fed.
All right, Vijay.
Sure. Look,
what do you think?
Like Amy, I think it's going to be the COVID hangover, right? Where we're going to have gone through a pretty big boom. Things will still be pretty good, I think, but, you know, it's definitely going to be a deceleration. I think, you know, we think the market's probably trading right around where we're trading now. So I don't think it's going to be all that different, because I do think it's going to get a little bit more difficult. And I'll say, you know, the one thing to watch out for, and I think this very much lends itself to what Pat just mentioned with the Fed and inflation, is, you know, if something goes wrong or something goes right that kind of dictates the Fed's move, I think we should watch oil and to a lesser extent, commodity prices more broadly. You know, if oil prices kind of stabilize or turn a little bit lower, you know, I think that will take some of the pressure off of the Fed. But if, you know, in May of 2022, we're looking at, you know, $80 oil or something like that, I think that's going to put a lot of pressure on the Fed to potentially go a little bit quicker. But at the same time, you know, higher oil prices at that point could weigh on the global economy as well. So I think there is a risk, you know, posed by higher commodity prices, you know, potentially this time next year. But I think that's something to watch.
Okay, well, listen, I we're out of time. I wish we had more. As always, a fascinating and thought-provoking panel. Pat Boyle of Bessemer, Vijay Shandar of Morgan Stanley, Amy Raskin of Chevy Chase Trust. Thank you all so much. Look forward to convening again and really appreciate your time.
Thank you. Take care.